You are listening to South by Southwest Sessions.
So what I want to talk about is, what do we want from online platforms? And this is kind of a talk in five parts. Let's start with the paperclip problem. So many of you may have heard of the paperclip problem. It's kind of a little philosophical story posed by the philosopher Nicholas Bostrom. And he says, imagine you have an AI, a general AI, an AI that really can think like a human, and you ask it to produce as many paper clips as possible. So fairly quickly, two things will occur to this AI. One is, human beings might shut me off. And if they shut me off, then I won't be able to produce as many paper clips as possible. And that would be a problem for my goal. And the second is that human beings have a lot of atoms in them that are really useful for making paper clips. And therefore, maybe the best way to make paper clips most efficiently is to just get rid of the humans. And so, this is one of the ways that you end up in that kind of AI-driven, post-apocalyptic hellscape that so many of us are living in these days. Recently I've been thinking about something that Tim O'Reilly, the tech entrepreneur and thinker, has been saying, which is that we sort of have these stories about what it's going to be like when there are super intelligent AIs. And the fact is that super intelligent AI is here. Their businesses, their corporations, their governments. And if you think about it, they do all the things that we imagine these super intelligent creatures would do. They gather a lot more information than a person ever could. They process it in these complex ways. They come to complex understandings that an individual wouldn't be able to based on all of the sensory input. And then they're able to act with a lot more force than one individual would be able to. And so, this isn't a future question. This is a present question. And in fact, lo and behold, I think we're living through a time when we're facing kind of the consequences of these paperclip problems, because we're tasking these really powerful entities with these very simple metric maximization problems. And lo and behold, there are bad consequences to that sometimes. And so if all you're trying to do with billions of dollars of capital and thousands of the world's smartest people is to try to get people to stay on page for a little bit longer or load a few more ads or whatever the metric is, then you start to run into some bad societal consequences. So what I want to suggest is that we've been having this conversation now about sort of the challenges of platforms and democracy for arguably for 20 years, definitely really intensely for the last 2 years, but there's a missing piece of the conversation. And I think it's that we can start to talk about what we think the harms are that the platforms are causing, but we haven't really figured out how to say in a way that, in a metrical way, in a way that organizations and computers understand, what it is that we want. How do we actually define what a healthy society might be? And how do we do that in a way that complex organizations that are numerically based can start to understand that? So to me, this has been like a really interesting question that I've been spending a lot of time on lately. And I think actually, there's a lot of reason to think about not just how to solve the problems that exist in our digital world, but also how to think about how do we flip it? How do we think about what is the positive version that we aspire to? So we can think about misinformation and disinformation, and you could maybe solve pieces of misinformation and disinformation and still not actually get to educated citizens. You might be able to solve harassment and bullying and still not get to a platform where people are able to actually exist with dignity and be themselves. You might be able to stop incitement against ethnic groups and still not end up in a world with increased tolerance. And so I think there's actually like a lot of reason to think about sort of how do we structure things in terms of these positive goals rather than just in terms of problems to fix. Another reason to think about this is, there's this great idea from a political scientist, Kludgeocracy. And Kludge, you know, if you work in tech, you know that Kludges are, you know, when you just kind of, something's broken, you patch it over with something else, that breaks, and you patch it over with something else, and pretty soon you end up with a big mess. And when you're just fixing problems one after the other, that's often what you end up with. And so I think, again, this is a moment when we need to think big. Let's think about not just how do we fix the problems that exist now, but what are the actual positive goods that we want to deliver, and how would we build for that? And then I think there's also a good reason to talk about positive goals is that, as it turns out, when you start pulling them apart, some of our positive goals are in conflict. And so I've been especially fascinated by some of the conversation over the last year or so in Facebook land about this effort, the initiative that it made called Meaningful Social Interactions. So Facebook basically said, it made this big change to the newsfeed. They said, you know, we realized that people are watching a lot of videos of like some dude surfing off his roof, and that makes them depressed and sad and alone. And in contrast, when they talk to other people, they feel better. And so we're going to do less of that. We're going to focus on highlighting interactions that really make people feel better about themselves and their community, and that'll be a contribution that we make to the world, which I think is really, you know, it's always hard to handicap Facebook's motives, but, you know, I think let's assume that it was meant well. So what's interesting is, you know, it's still located within this idea of we want to make an individual feel better. We're gonna focus on maximizing individual well-being. And it turns out that there's a challenge with that because there's kind of this other axis, which is kind of group well-being or civic well-being. So let's imagine, and I should have made these fonts bigger, but let's imagine that we've got these two, you know, these two verticals. So you've got high individual well-being up here, low individual well-being up here, over here, low civic health over here, and high civic health over here. So, you know, it's easy to see why it would be great to have things that are good for individual well-being and good for group well-being. Like, you participate in a PTA fundraiser and you feel rooted in your community and your community does better. And it's easy to see why, you know, downgrading content that's bad for people and bad for their communities, that's an easy call. But I think it's these other two quadrants that are complicated. So there's a lot of content. You know, Molly Tibbetts, you might remember, is like the woman who I think was killed by someone who was purportedly undocumented. It was this big story for a moment. And it turns out that when you're bonding with your friends and family, one of the things that people really like to bond with their friends and family over is how much they hate other people who are not like them. And so if you're trying to increase individual well-being, you know, you might actually be fanning the flames of polarization. And then let's think about this other quadrant, you know, which is high civic health, low well-being. You know, no one wants to realize they're wrong. It's an unpleasant feeling. I mean, God bless if you feel otherwise, but I don't. You know, yet this is a really important service to provide if you want a democracy to function well. So my point is that, you know, I think the Silicon Valley exists in this landscape of, you know, the whole thing was built on a process of individual maximization. And there isn't a lot of room in that ideology for how do we think about the well-being of groups as something separate. So again, I sort of just walked through this, but maximizing each individual's well-being is not the same as maximizing group well-being. And I think we need to get better at talking about and thinking about how do we measure that? How do we articulate that? How do we think about that? And I think the last reason that I'll just give you for why you know, thinking about positive goals is important is that neutrality is not going to convince anybody. You know, when a platform says they're neutral, I think that works when you're talking about, you know, the TCP/IP layer, the basic technical layers of the internet. But people have missed that, you know, when you move up the stack from electrons to people, there are emergent properties with people coming together in a group that don't exist with bits. And you start to have value judgments. And all human systems have value judgments. And so figuring out, being able to articulate a set of values that guide what you're doing is much more important, is critical, because they're gonna be there whether you like them or not. And the question is, how do you articulate what they are? And I think this has to be approached really carefully. I love this quotation. Once metrics are defined, they're like parasites or undead spirits. They take over human beings. How many people here can relate to that experience? All right, good. South by Southwest, I knew it. So metrics are dangerous. You know, but getting this right, I think, is really important, because if we can't articulate the qualities that we want for a public sphere, the qualities that we want for groups, what we're left with is this very desiccated, dry social existence. Okay, so part two, the person in the situation. A couple decades ago, a couple of social scientists wrote this book called The Person in the Situation, which, as a friend pointed out to me, it's sort of like the name of a book if you were trying to describe it and you couldn't exactly remember it. You know, it's like, it's a person and a situation. The Person in the Situation is actually a really profound book, and I want to just spend a minute talking about why I think when we're trying to think about how to design healthy online space, you know, there are some things that we've learned about spaces that are really important. So The Person in the Situation is kind of a review of 50 years of social psychology. What have we learned? And the fundamental idea is that as human beings, we tend to attribute behavior too much to individual character traits and too little to the environment and situation that we're in. And that empirically, we do this even in cases where it's very clear that the environment is causing a set of behavior rather than an individual's character. So it opens with this great story about a group of seminary students that are part of an experiment. And the seminary students are on their way, as part of this experiment, to give a lecture on the Good Samaritan. And half of the seminary students are told that they're a little bit late for the lecture, so they should really hurry. And half are told that they're early, they can take their time. And then, as it turns out, on the way to the lecture, there's a person incapacitated in a doorway, right? So the Good Samaritan in action right now. And what's fascinating is that, you know, whether the people tested high or low for altruism beforehand had very little effect on whether they stopped or they didn't stop. You know, their views on the importance of helping others wasn't very predictive. What was predictive was whether they were late or whether they were early, right? And so the situational effects of thinking that you're late or thinking that you're early had far more to do with this action, stopping and helping someone out, that we think of as indicative of character, but is actually indicative of often what situations that we're in. And you know, this is true across a wide range of contexts. It turns out that, you know, personalities just aren't that predictive of behavior as much as you'd think. They have some predictive ability, but actually a lot of us who are outgoing in some contexts are shy in other contexts. And what dictates whether we're one or the other is how we perceive what environment we're in. And it's interesting, you know, the book talks about the famous Milgram experiment, which is often seen as indicating something really powerful and important about human psychology. This is the, if you're not familiar with it, you know, people were asked, there was a stern guy in a lab coat standing behind people, telling them to shock people who they couldn't see if they didn't get the right answer on a test. And every time they didn't get the right answer, they would have to dial up the shock. And the question was, how far would they go? And people would actually go to the point of, like, thinking that they may have killed or incapacitated someone in the experiment, right? So it was seen as this morality tale about conformity and about our obedience to authority. But what the person in the situation points out is someone redid this experiment, And they simply offered people, they gave people like a little, like, I'm uncomfortable dissent button that they could press at any time. And all of a sudden, not a single person was willing to, you know, turn up the shocks to 100, right? People opted out very quickly when they just had the slightest, you know, sort of, it made it slightly easier to articulate that need. So again, let's think about this for a second in the context of social platforms. To me, what this says is, you know, that people's behavior is significantly constructed by their environment, and that small tweaks to that environment can radically change what we think of as their inherent moral, you know, character, or their inherent moral truth. And then the last piece, from this book on a similar line is about a food drive. And they asked people to separate people who they thought were virtuous and highly likely to donate a can of food, and people who they knew and they thought were very unlikely to donate a can of food. And then they asked people to, they made it easy for some of them to donate and hard for some of them to donate. And what was fascinating was, like, you got to choose who was going to donate, but the people who, and yes, the people who the people who people predicted were not likely to donate were a little less likely than the people who were predicted to be highly likely. But the people who were lowly likely to donate were much more likely than the people who, when it was made easy for them, they were much more likely to donate than the people who had a greater sort of character propensity, but it wasn't easy for them to do. So again, making things easy makes people do good things. Making things difficult makes even people who have an inherent character trait wanting to do something much less likely to do it. All right, so enough of canned food. So what I want to ask is, what kinds of situations happen in digital space? So if situations are so important for group behavior and individual behavior, what is the nature of the situations that are happening in digital space? And recently, I felt like there's a place where we could learn a lot. So in the 1950s, I want to suggest that digital public spaces are like urban spaces, and that we could learn a lot from what urban designers have learned about how to construct spaces that work for lots of different kinds of people. So in the 1950s, there was a particular style of urban development that was in vogue, and this is Stuyvesant Town in New York, but it was basically it was very homogenous. You had these big square buildings in parks, and not a lot of street life. And this was the era of Robert Moses. It was kind of this top-down mode of development. And along came Jane Jacobs in the early 60s, and she articulated this totally different way that was much more true to how people wanted to live, which was let's build things organically, let's have vibrant street life, let's have lots of different uses for each space, let's think about how we call people into the space, let's think about how to build public areas where people can congregate and private areas where they can be private. And it was this much more rich understanding of how humans congregate, and it's really had this huge effect on, on the way that cities are built and designed. And I have friends in architecture and urban design, and maybe people are here who say, we've still got a long way to go toward that. But I think there's actually something really important here. And I think in a way, you know, we're at that moment, this like new urban moment online, where we're running up against the limits of sort of homogenous, top-down, one-size-fits-all online communities, and we're trying to understand how to build spaces that actually work for people in this more real and vibrant way. And so when I look at, you know, I've been doing this deep dive into sort of urban design language, but I actually just think there's so much, this is the city of Toronto's, some of their like urban design mission. And if you just think about sort of how would you build online spaces that have the same kind of legibility and character and diversity and continuity that you build, that we're learning to build offline spaces for. I think that's the right shape of the challenge. I think thinking about online, digital interactions as a space, and thinking about urban spaces as a place of inspiration, I think could help us figure out what it is that we want from online platforms. So I want to share a few of the kind of what I'm starting to work on is with a bunch of collaborators trying to build a set of principles for how you might articulate these tendencies. And I want to share both some of the principles that we're thinking about and also a couple that we're not thinking about, which may be controversial and which I would love to hear your thoughts on. Probably not super controversial, but public-friendly spaces invite everyone to participate. And so I think, how do we imagine something that actually does invite all sorts of folks into the conversation in our online, in our digital spaces? How do we build digital spaces that encourage the humanization of others? So how do we see each other as people rather than as stereotypes? How do we build public-friendly spaces that cultivate belonging? Because we know that belonging is a critical part of feeling, being part of a democratic society. And then I also want to talk about a few things that we're not including. So this should make it more clear, but I'm going to suggest civility. Actually, I wouldn't put high on this list. So civility has been a big conversation lately, but civility often means, you know, essentially playing by the rules of whatever the dominant group is at the time. And I think we need to unpack that notion a little bit, because one person's incivility is another person's activism or another person's speaking truth to power. I think if we're doing a good job of creating humanizing spaces, maybe we can disagree pretty strongly and still have a society together. I want to suggest that, you know, not all conversations need to be equally diverse. We need to be inclusive, but a lot of theorists have said, like, it's only through online culture that groups in marginalized communities can actually get together and talk to each other, and you wouldn't want those conversations to be equally diverse. And so how do we provide, you know, in the same way that a city has different places with different ethnic and geographic character, but they're all linked together, you know, how do we build something like that? And then last, I want to suggest that polarization in and of itself, you know, may not be the thing to optimize against. We may not want to, there's a famous report from 1960s America where the American Political Science Association, maybe it was like 1959, got together and said, we need more polarization. And it's really boring to have two parties that basically agree. So disagreement is good. What we don't want is hatred. And how do we build spaces that allow for constructive disagreement? So these are the things that I've been thinking about for the last year. And it's really the beginning of a conversation. But to me, it's a really important conversation. Because our literature is replete with stories about kind of misguided wishes, right? Stories where, you know, you get the fish that grants the wishes up on land and you ask it for something and it's not quite what you wished for. And I really feel like that's the blessing and the curse of the moment that we're in right now, is that we have these institutions and we have these incredibly potent powers as a civilization that we can ask them to do whatever it is that we want to do, but we have to ask well. We have to know what we want. And when it comes to creating the bedrock for a better society, I think we can do better in being able to articulate what those values are, what the principles are. And so that's the conversation that I'm really excited about and the one that I'm hoping to have with you all for a little bit and continue on through the next year. So. Thank you. All right, so let's go to some questions. Julie L. asks, how can technology ever be truly healthy if it's built on a surveillance business model? So I don't know is my answer. I think business models may make some of these traits very difficult or impossible. My view is that even if we scrap the advertising business model or the surveillance business model entirely, let's say we like get rid of that paradigm entirely, it would be very easy for us to recreate in the Wikipedia of, you know, in the Wikipedia version of Facebook, it would be very easy for us to recreate a lot of the same problems that we've had in these previous platforms. And so, to me, it's not all driven by, the business model is a problem, no doubt, but it's not all driven by the business model. And some of it is about how do you structure, what are the ways that you can bring people together that pull out the best parts of ourselves, and what are the ways that you bring people together that don't, you know, encourage the worst parts of ourselves. And, you know, again, if you think about the park metaphor, you know, there are some parks that really work for lots of different kinds of people, and there are some that are really, you know, depressing and, we need to think about what are the design principles that guide us toward one versus the other. All right, next question. What is your opinion of media's tendency to put a negative spin on titles to attract viewership? Does that play into low well-being? A negative spin on titles to... So this is like fear-mongering news, I'm thinking, whoever said this. I'm going to answer that question. Okay, so let's pretend that this question is, what... media tends to like make people worried to attract viewership, and how does that play into low well-being? And if that's the question, I totally agree. And I think it's actually like a real challenge of this moment that as I've been doing this reading about sort of what economists have found about the qualities of a healthy society or a strong society, happy society versus less happy societies. One of the most fascinating things was that they pulled out these two different qualities. So one was crime, the actual level of crime, and one was perception of crime. And it turns out that crime and perception of crime do not correlate. They don't happen in the same countries. They don't happen with the same people. Old, wealthy people generally perceive there to be a lot of crime, whereas younger, poorer people are the people who actually tend to be victims of crime. And so what these economists realized is that you have to tackle these as two separate problems, because there's the perception of fear, and then there's the actual, you know, social problem of crime. And I think that there's something really similar happening online right now where, it's like our social capacity for fear and for threat perception has gotten fairly detached from the actual things that we ought to be afraid of or perceive as threats. And media obviously plays a big role in kind of like ballooning some of those things and totally hiding others of them. I've always felt that there was a better way that ought to be possible for people to voice their longer-term concerns. And so the example I'll give is, in this last election, like if you polled Americans, anyone know what the number one like concern voiced by Americans in the last election was? It was high medical bills. It was like high hospital bills was like the number one thing that came up on surveys. How many articles did any of us read about high? I read like one on Vox. But that was not like a media firestorm, but it was actually on the minds of huge numbers of people. And so an interesting question is like, if you're doing public-friendly design, how could you surface what's actually, you know, it's not like you're imposing something on people. You're actually like just lifting up this latent concern that so many people are feeling in a way that media could speak to it, politicians could speak to it, you could have a better conversation. Let me go to, if digital should be treated as urban spaces, how do you envision the mayorship of the space? Great question. So I think this is a really important question, and to some degree I've been sidestepping it because I think it's really hard in a different way. But I do think like it's one of the challenges of this moment and of our current online space that you know, we live in the public spaces that we have aren't public. And they're owned by a handful of individuals who can essentially do with them what they want. And it's this very complicated quasi-public situation that's actually in the hands of a private corporation. Ultimately, I don't think, I'm not someone who believes in kings. And I think we're living in an era of kings. Like Zuckerberg has complete control over Facebook. He can do whatever he wants with it. And I don't even judge his character as harshly as some do. But I don't think anyone, however virtuous, any one individual can or should decide how a whole society lives its life. So I think ultimately, like, this is the big question, is how do we build systems that allow more of us to participate in the construction of our own digital space? And I know there are a lot of people here who are working on that question, but to me that's like central because we're only going to be spending more time in these places, and if they're really constructed in this top-down way, or if one person has the ability to turn it on or off, I just don't think that's we won't be like fulfilling our destiny as humans if we go down that road. Next question, and I'll do two more maybe, and then we can break and I can hang out. But do we need to agree on the metrics or even the values we use to measure what a good society looks like in order to ask institutions what we want well? Do we need to agree on the metrics or the values we use to measure what a good society looks like in order to ask institutions what we want? Well, okay. I do think that this is a time when we need to remind ourselves why democracy matters. Like, I think I certainly have grown up in an era where I sort of took it for granted. And wouldn't have imagined that there was a better system. And I think there are a bunch of important things about how democracies are structured and about the values behind democracies that are not inevitable, that are not, that can go away. And with them go away a lot of other things, including people's ability to be free in certain ways. And so, I do think like there needs to be some, we don't need to agree on lots of different, there are many values on which we can disagree, but to me like part of what we need to do is reestablish our commitment to some of these democratic values, these values about how people ought to come together in society and for what purposes, that make all of the other stuff possible. So it's not a totally, like, I think the easy answer is everyone should believe whatever they want to believe, but I actually just think groups of people, certainly countries and civilizations, can't operate without some shared agreement about what the rules of the road are, and I fear that we're kind of losing them right now. What would be the first step in building a more heterogeneous online society? I'll close on this one. So I think the first step of anything is like imagining it. And I think we're living in sort of borrowed worlds right now. We're living in worlds that we rent from Facebook in exchange for our data or Twitter. And there are a lot of people here who are trying to build something different. What I worry is that often the visions that that people have when they're building something different have to do with making something a little easier for a person, or a little making a person a little more happy or a little more content. But that they often aren't focused on these questions of kind of like, how do groups of people come together well, and how do big groups of people come together well? And I think there's so much richness there, and there's so much power there. And there's also so much to learn from centuries and centuries of philosophy and political science and about and religion, about sort of how people come together well. And how could we bake that into the visions that we have for what a digital future looks like? To me, like, that's a really interesting set of questions. And I think, to be clear, I don't think there is one right answer at all. And I think, you know, a more heterogeneous, a more vibrant and human online space looks like lots of different spaces that share some commonalities, that are cross-connected, but that aren't just one thing for everyone, because we're not all the same. We don't need the same things. And so so I think the first step to building that space is to start talking about it and imagining it and trying to imagine it really clearly. And I'm down to do that with anyone who wants to do that with me. So thank you so much for your time, for coming out, and for this conversation. Really appreciate it.